From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
And I'm John Wells. Our first guest is Hans Iserman. He's the foremost expert on social thermoregulation in humans. His writing has appeared in the New York Times and the Huffington Post. He joins us from France, the University of Grenoble Alps, where he is an associate professor. Now, besides breathing, regulating body temperature is one of the most fundamental tasks for any animal. Like huddling penguins, humans have long relied on one another to maintain our temperatures. Over millennia, this instinct for thermoregulation has shaped our lives and culture. Iserman's new book is heartwarming, How Our Inner Thermostat Made Us Human, and is an illuminating investigation of core body temperature regulation and its powerful effect on human civilization, and it explores the thermoregulation through the long lens of evolution. Hans, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we very much enjoyed your book from the perspective of the body's regulation of heat. How did you get interested in this topic?
So within social psychology, I was first interested in culture, actually, in what is called honor culture. That's a type of culture that you also have in the southern part of the United States. Then a professor that I work with at the University of Illinois got me thinking about the role of a body in culture. And I started getting more and more interested in how the body shapes the mind. And from there, it was a relatively small leap to thinking about one of the things that moves us the most, which is, I think, is temperature. And I think it's one variable that, even though it's not that obvious to most of us, because we regulate it all the time, once you see it, you cannot unsee it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I have a very good friend. He's probably my best friend growing up from the Boston area. He passed away a couple of years ago. And every once in a while, when I think about him, think about our adventures together, and, you know, he was a very gregarious, but a very humble and a very kind person. Every time I think about him, I get this big smile on my face, and it's a, and I can actually feel a physical warmth. And now I understand, after reading your book, that there's science that supports this. Thinking about friendly or caring people can make us warmer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sorry to hear about your friend. But yes, so there is indeed, there are studies that we've done where we reminded people of people that they love, people that they feel close to. And then after reminding them about people that they feel close to, we simply ask them, what do you think the ambient temperature of the room is right now? And when we manipulated kind of the idea of thinking about somebody that they love, they estimate the temperature to be higher. And conversely, also, if you think about being more psychologically distant from other people, you think that the surrounding temperature is lower.
Mm. I'd love to come back to this, but I'm just dying to know, Hans, my big question has always been, why is it that some people run hot and some people run cold? I know that we think of it as maybe, you know, your relative body fat, but there must be something more to it than that.
Yeah, so that was also an interesting question. I think this question, when people were asking me this question, was the reason why I also went further to look at individual differences. And indeed, you know, one thing that you say that is relatively obvious is body fat, or just body size. So for animals, including humans, if you get further away from the equator, they tend to be bigger because they can regulate heat better. Animals closer to the equator, they tend to have longer limbs because they can dissipate heat better. But also in humans, what at a certain point we were interested in kind of investigating, are there differences inter-individually in relation to how people socially regulate their temperature? At least what we know so far is that some people desire to regulate temperature more with others. And these typically tend to be people that also share their emotions more frequently with others. So those people tend to rely more on others for temperature regulation.
Wow, that's fascinating. And I'm also wondering, I have a tendency to drink much more water if it is hot or warm. And I don't love cold water. In fact, I'll literally become dehydrated if I have to drink cold water all the time. I just love the heat. Does that have some effect or is on my internal thermostat?
You mean the drinking of water?
Well, just whether or not we prefer really hot beverages. And for me, the hotter, the better. And maybe I feel like I need to warm myself from the inside out.
So there are different ways of regulating your own temperature. One is to outsource it to other people. But of course, the other one is to do it by yourself. And this is just a behavioral way of regulating temperature. So many animals do this. So also animals that are unlike humans, so ectotherms that regulate temperature internally. So they do this through external methods.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Hans Roka Iserman, who is the foremost expert on social thermoregulation in humans. He has just written a fascinating book, Heartwarming, How the Inner Thermostat Made Us Human. Hans, I have to ask you a really interesting chapter titled From Depression to Cancer. And in this chapter, you talk about whole body hypothermia that's used as a treatment for people with depressive disorders and sometimes folks that have Lyme disease or metastatic cancer. Can you tell us about that and what some of the research tells us?
Yeah, so I'll focus on the depression example first because I think it's closer to some of the topics that we've been discussing. So far, I was emailed at one point when I wrote that article in the New York Times. So this was more about temperature regulation and when we feel excluded, then we tend to get colder. And a well-renowned therapist, Aaron Beck, emailed me and with the observation saying that oftentimes depressed people tend to feel cooler, at least that's what he observed in his patients. There are some studies that now tend to show that when their entire body is warmed up, that this tends to lower their depressive symptoms. However, I think many of the studies in that chapter are a little bit speculative still, because the science is still emerging on thermoregulation, and the links to depression are not as strong as I would like them to be. Now, making the link also to cancer, the issue there is similar. So there's one important tissue for thermoregulation called brown adipose tissue. Kind of brown adipose tissue is the insulating material for our body. Up until about 2007, we thought that we did not have this in adult humans, but only in babies. And what it appears is that we have it as well as adult humans. In mice, this tissue has been linked to cancer and to tumor growth. So the more brown adipose tissue there is in the body, the faster tumor grows in mice. That effect is not there yet found in humans. So the link is speculative, but there is a word of warning because oftentimes brown adipose tissue by many people in medicine is considered to be good because it's also linked negatively to obesity. So people that tend to have more of it tend to be less obese. But there may be some warning signals that actually having more brown adipose tissue can increase your risk for tumor growth. So those are some of the lessons that you can already learn from thermoregulation. But a lot of the research, particularly in humans, still needs to be done. But the links are very clear that they're probably there.
Hans, I'm wondering, excuse me, the brown adipose tissue, you just said that the more we have of it, those who have more tend to be thinner. Is that right? And the reason I asked this question is I had a friend some years ago who was quite thin, but he insisted on always having the temperature of the room being much colder. And he would talk about trying to develop his brown adipose tissue.
So this is actually a very known well effect called fat browning. So when you sleep in a colder room, for example, white fat tends to turn into brown fat. So this is a method to develop your brown fat indeed. But metabolically, this is very, very expensive because brown fat costs your body a lot of energy. So it's actually a question whether it's a good thing to do because metabolically, it takes you a lot of energy to heat up every day to rely on brown adipose tissue alone.
Yeah, interesting. So can we go into evolution a little bit? John, my co-host, might have a lot of you know, hair on his head or fur on his face, but over over the time he has lost a lot of that, and I have even less of it. Can you talk a little bit about our evolution of losing body fur?
So for a long time also, this was partly related to walking upright, and researchers or theorists thought that for a long time that walking upright mostly had to do with thermoregulation, and that we also would keep the hair on our head basically to resist the heat. But new models actually don't confirm that. So probably there are other links that that were more related to that.
Hans, I wanted to ask you about something that I just found fascinating. In your book, you talk about our outer shell, which is our skin, and it has more cold receptors than warm receptors. And it is primarily there to detect decreases in ambient temperature. And our brain, which is our inner shell, has more warm receptors than cold receptors. How do those work together and work on their own?
Yeah, so this is a very interesting asymmetry. That indeed the brain has more warmth receptor than cold receptors. So when the temperature goes up, this is immediately dangerous for the human body. So we need to take action immediately. If you're not able to downregulate temperature, either internal or either by yourself through sweating, or for example, by jumping in the pool or drinking a cold beer, then you immediately either suffer brain malfunction or you die. So the brain, the body needs to basically act immediately. For the cold, this is the other way around. So you're not nearly as vulnerable for the cold as for the heat. So you can lose a lot of temperature essentially, and this can take a while before there's an actual danger. So there's an interesting consequence to that. So because it means that for increases in temperature, we cannot rely on other people to help us downregulate. We need to do this by ourselves. However, for decreases in temperature, particularly in older times when we didn't have all these central heating systems, when we did not wear clothes, we would regulate temperature socially. So we could rely on others to warm up because there was not an immediate threat when basically the temperature went down.
Hans, I certainly understand that we have a subconscious brain that maybe does 90% of the things for our body that is not known to us. It's below our conscious, our ability to understand. And I also understand that we have more cold receptors on our skin, and in our brain we have more warm receptors. But if you could maybe tell me how this happens, when I'm out in the cold, it just doesn't bother me that much. But if I walk into a room and there's a roaring fireplace and all of a sudden I get hot, I instinctively move away from that fire. How does the brain communicate that?
That is a much more complicated question than it seems. Because first you talk about thermal receptors when you go outside versus the threat of a fire by itself. So there will be different areas of the brain responsible for those two different processes, where there's one more related to a threat and the other one where it's mostly related to temperature regulation. So when you go outside, for example, and the temperature is low, what the body will do is it will immediately respond to it by your outer shell, which you referred to previously. Your peripheral temperature goes down to protect the core. Whereas when you can come closer to a fire, your brain will rapidly start firing to basically take action immediately and to get away from the fire. So the brain will respond much more rapidly for heat than for coldness.
That's fascinating.
We're speaking with Hans Roscha Eijerman. He's an associate professor in social psychology and the foremost expert on social thermoregulation in humans. Hans, I'm just going to ask this question because I know John won't ask it. What about hot flashes during menopause? I just have to ask that question because I'm wondering, is there any way that you can have sort of mind control over something like a hot flash?
So this is a very interesting question, and one that we haven't explored yet, but is high on our list to explore, because we are doing studies also where, for example, have couples to come to our lab, and we take pictures of them looking sad or looking angry or looking happy. And then we look at how their partner responds in peripheral temperature. And we have this idea that people can co-regulate each other. So our primary interest is what is this effect on relationships? And we're looking to kind of affirm this paradigm to also see what is the influence for women going through menopause? Does this change their social relationship, yes or no? At the moment, we don't have a good answer to it yet, but this is high on our list to explore. However, there is a company that I've been working with, Ember Labs, and one of their goals is also to increase thermal comfort. And actually, their biggest customer base is women with menopause. So they develop a wristband that can heat or cool, and it gives instant comfort to cool down during hot flashes. So that's more from a comfort perspective. From the science perspective, we're not there yet, but it's higher on our list to explore.
Mm, that's very interesting. Well, along those lines, but a little bit different, you know, we all have talked about during these COVID times that, well, many of us just miss the warm embrace, being able to hug your loved ones or even, you know, just upon greeting an acquaintance. The hug is such a beautiful thing. And I'm wondering, you know, where the hug kind of figures into this thermoregulation. Do we seek out the warm feeling of someone else's body?
Yeah, so this is also a question that we've kind of wanted to explore at the beginning of this pandemic. I mean, we're still interested in exploring, but it's a very complicated question and it takes a lot of research to figure out. Because in principle, with those wristbands that I was talking about, you can simulate also contact from a distance. So then you would have to, we are working with sensors to measure temperature from moment to moment. And then we can make this contact responsive from a distance. So that's one way, of course, for more intimate contact. But I think one of the aspects that we're also missing is this more coziness of our social relationships that indeed, that are not necessarily the relationships that you deal with from day to day. So we miss, for example, the strange contacts of people on the streets that you see or in the stores. That's also kind of this coziness of, for example, Christmas. And I think a lot of a lot of us are lacking this now. In my own language, Dutch, there is the word gezelligheid, which is comparable to a concept that is better known in the United States called hygge, the Danish concept that I think many people know is hygge. And this is kind of the coziness that you think about when it's cold and you're with others around a campfire. Or, for example, you're out in the stores around Christmas time and you really feel that coziness. And I think that's one facet that we're missing right now. In one of the chapters, I also talk about a study that we did where people further away from the equator, what seems to protect our core body temperature is their participation in diverse social networks. So this is not only intimate relationships, but for example, also relationships in volunteer networks, in church groups, in sports teams. And this, for some reason, we don't know why, protects their core body temperature. So it's this gezelligheid, this hygge, this coziness that tends to protect core body temperature. And we don't have a good intervention for this yet at the moment, but we do think simulating this in some way can probably contribute actually to people feeling more connected.
Hans, Lynn and I work and live in Park City, and in the wintertime we get our fair share of what I call bluebird days, you know, beautiful blue skies, brilliant sun. And I know from growing up in Massachusetts and the Boston area that in the wintertime, it's pretty gray. As a matter of fact, I was home for Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays, both holidays, and during those two holidays, there was only one day of sunshine. And I wanted to ask you, what is the latest on SAD, the acronym for seasonal disorder? Can you talk about what we've learned recently about that?
Yeah, so first, I also visited Park City. It's actually a beautiful area. And so I'm a little bit familiar with the area. I've loved visiting there. In relation to SAD, there's actually a good study from the Netherlands. So the Netherlands also, I think, is very similar to Massachusetts, at least in terms of its gloominess. that there's a large part of the year where it's very dark and gray, and we have a lot less sun there than what you would have in Park City. But even though intuitively it seems that there should be strong evidence for SAD, seasonal affective disorder, there was a very nice study from the Netherlands, a very large study, where they found no clear indication of seasonal affective disorder. So that when the weather turns grayer, that you feel more depressed. That doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't exist. It could also be a measurement issue. But so far, there's no clear evidence in favor of seasonal affective disorder.
And sometimes the flip the flip side can occur, because you also state in your book, in Finland, suicide rates correlate with the onset of relatively high springtime temperatures. And suicide in Finland suggests it's increased sunlight, not decreased temperatures, that correlates with this increase in suicide. How large was that study?
I'd have to be, I'm sorry to go and say that I don't remember exactly the numbers on that that specific study. The one thing that is interesting about that, though, where there's a very suggestive and important link, is also its link with brown adipose tissue that we talked about before.
Yes.
That it seems to be about the activation of brown adipose tissue that causes this effect. So sorry for not remembering that specific detail. So I'll have to look it up at some point and get back to you.
So what you're saying is that during this cold, dreary winter in Finland, people's vessels constrict more and they produce more of the brown?
Their brown adipose tissue is more activated. So it's more, it also becomes, it warms people up a little bit more. It costs them a little bit more energy. So that's what's the case there.
Okay.
Hans, since you mentioned that you're Dutch, I just have to bring up a fellow countryman, Wim Hof.
Yes.
Many of us here in the States, you know about Wim Hof, and he is the one who famously takes prolonged dips in icy water, cold plunges, and walks around barefoot in the snow and that sort of thing. I'm just wondering, well, why and how it has made his particular constitution evolve.
Yeah, so first, I think it's amazing what he does. Like, I could not replicate that. It's to an extent that sometimes we think it's crazy what he does, because it's something that most people cannot do. He runs up the Mount Everest, he sits in ice water, and it's pretty amazing. Why I would not know why he does that, but I think, of course, he strongly believes that there are strong health benefits and strong mental health benefits for doing so. So it's probably the reason also why he engages in and also tries to kind of carry it out to other people, is because he thinks there are many health benefits to it. And also, to his credit, he has worked with many scientists to try to figure out, how does this work? Does this work? Is there any evidence behind that these cold treatments and also kind of hyperventilation training, does that work for people's mental health and for their physical health?
Mm. Yeah, that's so interesting that it also pertains to mental health. And maybe it has a lot to do with just the mental clarity that is produced. I can only imagine. But that, you know, it leads me to the next question. And in Europe, you all have, you're so into the spa culture. And a lot of these cold plunge, then into the sauna, then back to the cold plunge. And I can imagine that the constriction of the blood vessels and then the expanding of the blood vessels is very good for us. It increases blood flow. But I was curious about anything that you could comment on that, you know, further reasons that you do that. And I wonder why Americans, we don't have this as a regular practice.
Yeah, in relation to the spa culture itself, I don't know of any good studies that demonstrate the benefits of it. I mean, I can say that I enjoy it. And also the Wim Hof training, for example, the shower training, I do it myself from time to time. In relation to, for example, the Wim Hof training method, there are some studies that tend to suggest that there's a small increase in terms of people's control over their autonomic nervous system. And that could potentially contribute also to their stress regulation. However, in relation to these studies, they are relatively small, and if what we call in psychology effect sizes, so how much of an effect does this training have, seem to be very modest. So they oftentimes they seem very promising in terms of what they promise, but it's not as much as we would like them to be.
Hans, are you familiar with the American movie The Exorcist?
I have seen it a long time ago, so I can, yeah. I have to remain it then.
Oh, yeah. I'm not going to ask you about the movie, but the the movie was filmed in Georgetown, which is a section of Washington, D.C., where I went to school. It's where I went to college. And when the film came out, they had free screenings. You know, college kids love stuff that's free, at the special movie theater where they brought in these extra air conditioning units. And this is during the winter. And we were all sitting on the edge of our seats shivering watching this movie. And, of course, the movie scared the daylights out of us just like it scared most people. And I wanted to ask you, is there a relationship between lower ambient temperatures and a heightened sense of emotion?
There seem to be some studies that suggest, for example, that fear can be exacerbated. Now, we have recently done kind of a collection of studies where we analyze many studies at the same time, and then we look at what is the evidence in this collection of studies. So far, at the moment, we have not found a robust link between temperature and specific emotions that people feel. That doesn't mean that link is not there, but I think that the study quality is not super high in the studies that have been done. So far, there's no direct evidence. Even though I do think the evidence will get there once the study that have been done will be higher.
Yeah. Hans, before we let you go, and we could talk to you all morning, this is a fascinating conversation. As you did your research for your book, what most surprised you?
So I think one that is really, really kind of cool is a behavior called kleptothermy. Where specific animals, they steal heat from other animals. And they do so, for example, so some sea snakes, what they do, they sneak into burrows occupied by large tropical seabirds, or specific snakes in Canada, what they do, they pretend to be female, so they produce pheromones, and they fool other males, and many males climb on top of them, and they steal the heat from the other snakes. And I thought this was just a fascinating phenomenon that's just, in a way, bizarre. But this is what certain animals do.
Well, Lynn and I both very much enjoyed your book. And there's so much good information in it. So, Hans, we want to thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio. Again, your book is titled Heartwarming, How the Inner Thermostat Made Us Human. Hans, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.